If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars, as they say. And this week is a very special week because it's the last episode of the year. Yes, I'll be taking a break for a couple of weeks, but this is the last episode of the year. It's episode 167, and we've got a very special guest on the show. His name is Alex Fatal. He has more knowledge and more in-depth, let's say, insights into Colombia and the peace process and what's going on. But he's speaking to us today from the United States, and we want to talk to him about his relationship with Colombia and the projects that he has been pursuing over the years. So, Alex, welcome on the show.
Thank you, Richard. Great to be here.
You're most welcome. Now, Alex, are you at Penn State at the moment? Is that where you are? You're an assistant professor there.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
perfect.
Excellent.
So I'm just gonna give you a little bit of a background here for my listeners. You're an assistant professor of Penn State Film, Video, Media Studies with an expertise in media warfare in Colombia. That's right. I mean, so let's start from the very beginning, Alex. How did you end up with such a strong relationship or interest in Colombia?
Well, it started a long time ago. I won a Fulbright scholarship to come to Colombia in 2001. And that was really a transformative year. I couldn't have foreseen the effect that year would have on my life. I had studied abroad in Chile as an undergraduate student in 1999 and very much enjoyed being in Latin America. I wrote an undergraduate thesis about the role of photography in the South African liberation struggle. So I was interested in the politics of the photographic image and thought that Colombia would be an interesting place to explore those issues. Applied for this grant and really had no expectation of winning it. And then when I won the grant, next thing I knew, I was on a plane coming to Colombia for a year in 2001, which of course is when the war is very much at its height. And that in fact was something that I did not entirely appreciate at the time, because I only knew kind of a fraction about the country as I do now. But I started speaking to photographers and editors and journalists and curators and a lot of people who were involved in the production and circulation of photographic images about the conflict, to try to think about how it's being represented and to kind of compare and contrast the types of representations that were being made by Colombian photographers versus foreign photographers, and what differences in the gaze or differences in selection criteria in the editorial rooms were happening, and how that affected different representation of the conflict. And that was all very interesting and illuminating, but it was still within a very academic framework, and I had just finished my undergraduate studies. And, you know, as 22-year-olds tend to desire, I wanted to get out into the world and do something a little bit less academic, do something that was informed by my recent studies. And So I started teaching photography to a group of young people who were living in Altos de Cazuca, just southwest of Bogota. At that point, the Transmilenio was still being constructed, going out down the Autopista Sur, and it would take nearly 2 hours to get to the neighborhood from downtown Bogota. And I would go up about three times a week and work with a group of young people affiliated to an informal education project, un proyecto comunitario that was known as Corporación Fe y Esperanza, run by a community leader by the name of Nelson Pájaro. He himself had been displaced and had opened up a school to give the kids some semblance of education, even though his school wasn't accredited by the Ministerio de Educación. And so I just started working with about 30 kids and talking about photography and bringing photographic books and ultimately bringing cameras and film and inviting the kids to do photo essays around four different themes: memory, future, family, and fear. And that project went exceedingly well. And it was embraced by the kids, the parents, the community, and it was kind of my entree into Colombia. It kept me coming back. So after working for about a year with these students, we did an exhibition in the Casa de la Cultura in Soacha. It was a kind of an ironic exhibition because the mayor's office doesn't recognize those barrios, but was eager to host this exhibition and claim some sort of credit for it. But in any case, the media loved the project. It turned into one of these cultural projects, kind of like the Colegio del Cuerpo in Cartagena. There are a few of these very celebrated cultural projects. And so we had a full page in El Tiempo one Sunday. We were on the cover of El Espectador magazine. We had Piri coming up and doing a special section on the kids. So, you know, that was as my grant was expiring, my year in Colombia was expiring. And a bunch of people came up to me and said, well, we have to continue this. We shouldn't let this just fall. And so we started a foundation called Disparando Cámaras para la Paz, or Shooting Cameras for Peace. And that project went on for about 7 years. So it was active from 2002 to 2009.
That's pretty incredible, I have to say. And I mean, you just chose Cazuca, or was it through the foundation that the school led by the displaced person that was most of interest to you? I mean, it's not a barrio, I have to say. You know, I've lived now 10 years here in Colombia. I've never been to Cazuca. I passed through Soacha on occasion. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what Cazuca was like in 2001, 2002? I'm sure it hasn't changed too much, but can you give us, what was your reception like when you arrived?
Yeah, well, these are great questions. Yeah, I learned about Nelson through a woman working at a NGO in Chapinero, who this NGO had organized a photo competition for best images of the Colombian conflict. So I was interviewing her about that. And I kind of, at the end of the interview, mentioned this idea that I had to start to work with students who themselves had been displaced as a form of historical memory, even though we weren't really using the term historical memory at the time. And she says, oh, you need to speak to Nelson. So that's how that connection came about. And it was very clear to me that this was a very intense and difficult situation with a lot of extreme poverty and violence. These were neighborhoods that were undergoing a process of paramilitarization. All of the different armed actors are active in the neighborhood. It was made clear to me that I needed to be on my way out of the neighborhood no later than 5 o'clock every afternoon. So there's limpieza social, there's all sorts of the ills that are all too common in Colombia. But strangely, you know, because they are so close to the city, they're even more overlooked in a way. And we tend to think about the war as being in places like Monteria or Umayo or Catatumbo or north of the Cauca, etc. But a lot of the neighborhoods that ring a lot of Colombians' major cities are experiencing a low intensity conflict as well. That is, taking a great toll on the people who live there, who are just trying to make a living and support their families. So, and as you say, it remains in largely the same state that it was in 2001. Ironically, the neighborhood that I worked in was called El Progreso, right, or Progress. Subsequent mayors have been trying to legalize some of the barrios, and there's been a process of some legalization, which has been good. They've tried to construct some public housing at the base of the mountain. There's a lot of quarries that make the mountainside on which the people construct their houses particularly precarious in the winters. And I think there's been a lot of movement to try to relocate people off of those cliffs. So I don't want to say there hasn't been any progress, but it's still a crisis.
And the only reports we ever get, let's say in the mainstream press here in Bogota or in Colombia, is of course negative reports about Cazuca. It's never anything positive in Cazuca. And unfortunately, I think this will continue. And this, but I mean, this project that you were working on, let's say from 2002 to 2009, I mean, not many people get to work on a project of this level for 7 years. I mean, the findings must have been just fascinating.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that this project, really found a thirst for an opportunity. You know, I mean, the students in this neighborhood were so eager, and some of them so talented, for an opportunity that when I arrived at this idea, this quirky idea of a participatory photography project, it was really refreshing to see how they jumped at the opportunity and they were really soaking it up. And just to clarify, it's not that I was involved in the daily operations project for all 7 years. It was this nonprofit and involved a lot of people, a lot of different talleristas and people who were running the workshops and things like that. So I was kind of in the background, supporting from afar for the most part, making connections and helping out where I could. In 2006, I started my own doctoral studies. And there I was taking up issues of representation in the Colombian conflict in a different way. But this project has always been very close to my heart. And we donated the archive first to the Museum of Bogota. We've subsequently moved it to the University of Los Andes' art department. And we've been scanning the archive of nearly 10,000 images. And we're going to be creating a book of photographs. This will be a bilingual book and should come out in 2018. Yeah. So we've probably got about a year and a half. But it's looking really spectacular. The images are superb, and they're not only images. Oftentimes the students will use an image as a kind of jumping off point to talk about their lives and talk about something that's important to them.
This makes me think of a book that I had and I bought when I lived in Guatemala in 1998. It was Children of the Dump.
That's a new year.
There you go, you know it. But you're showing incredible humility, Alex. I have to say, you know, that you say it's very close to your heart. Of course it is. You are you grew up with this for 7 years, really. Now tell me, are you still in touch with the people in Cazuca? When was the last time you visited?
I was there a year and a half ago, and I'm in touch with some of the folks. in 2011, I curated an exhibition at Harvard's Peabody Museum, and I went back to interview some of the former students to figure out where they are now, what they remember from the photography project, how they feel that it might have impacted them. And a lot of the kids have kids of their own at this point. And often the project that they most favorably remembered was the pinhole camera, which transforming a jar or a can into a camera estenopeica, right? So you can take these kind of blurry portraits of yourself and your friends and learn the basics of photography in the process. And that, you know, this really overlaid quite, you know, in quite an interesting way with local practices of recycling, right? In terms of collecting materials that people would throw out and using them for scraps and reselling them. And this rumor apparently had circulated throughout the hills that there was a group of photographers who were taking pictures with cans. And this, you know, this became quite a draw to the program.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is phenomenal. I mean, really, you know, the things that people remember and what they appreciate the most. And I'm looking forward to this book. I'm sure there'll be a launch here in Bogota. So therefore, in 2018, I'm not going anywhere. I'm still working on my doctoral study, so I'll still be here. We're talking to Alex Fatal. You can check out his website, Alex Fatal. That's F-A-T-T-A-L, and you find him easily online. We're going to take a short break and be back with Alex talking further about his relationship, really, with Colombia and the projects he has got set up and in motion here. It's been really fascinating to hear about a different side to life in the city, in the big city, and near to Bogota. So this is episode 167. I'm Richard McCall talking to Alex Fatal. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, and we're talking to Alex Fatal, who's up there in the United States at Penn State, and we're talking about his relationship with Colombia. And really, it has been a phenomenal conversation thus far, talking about your project, Shooting Cameras for Peace, a project that ran from 2002 to 2009 in the Altos de Cazuca, a really impoverished, let's say, barrio de invasión, extension of displaced people in southwestern Bogota. And there's a book coming out in 2018, which I am looking forward to, because this looks exciting to me, to have something that's so revealing and so long-term. I mean, you know, a seven-year project is long-term. Alex, tell me, when you have been or have met up with these former students, let's say, children who are, you know, hanging out with you and learning about photography and now have their own kids, you're saying that the what they enjoyed the most was like the pinhole camera, which I find, you know, what a great story. I can actually imagine it. It's very tangible. Have there been, you know, good news stories from these kids in Cazuca who have gone through this, you know, the 7 years and have, let's say, been able to put their lives into a more positive, or have they been able to, let's say, get out of the misery of Cazuca? I mean, maybe not physically, but maybe economically.
Well, it's a mixed bag. Yeah, it's a mixed bag, and it's hard to draw any causal relationships. But you know, some people have gone to the army. Some people have found stable employment. Some people have moved down the hillside. Other people have fallen into drug addiction. Other people have all sorts of difficulties, and the structural problems facing them aren't going to be addressed only with a photography project. But there's been a secondary literature about Shooting Cameras for Peace. There's been doctoral dissertations that have been written about the program, and dissertations in fields like social work, dissertations in fields like psychology. And generally, their findings are the program has a very positive effect in terms of fostering a sense of self-confidence and self-esteem and feeling that these people are equal citizens. Oftentimes they travel buses throughout Bogota and find themselves in different parts of the city. They can very easily feel like they're second-class citizens, that, you know, immediately an employer will ask them, well, where are you from? And they'll say, Altos de Casuca, and immediately that stigma will follow them. And I think by presenting their work in exhibitions, in cultural spaces, in going to other high schools, in going and speaking to university students, I think there's a real process of self-valorization that comes with participation in the program. We had a particular group of students, which were known as the monitores, who had been in the program for multiple years and then would help bring other students along. And those in particular, I think, benefited from this sense of empowerment through the project.
Of course, I can see that. I can see it happening. And of course, yes, we can't expect one project to change everything, but of course, there must be positive outcomes from such a project. And really interesting. And this issue of stigma, you know, being stigmatized for living in an area which you didn't have a lot of say in. I mean, this is the truth. But you come from there immediately, you're probably a bandit. You know, if you're in Chapinero, someone would say, oh, Altos de Casuca, you know, mal lugar, bad place, etc. But let's move on then, because this is a really, I mean, it's a fantastic project. And as I said, I'm looking forward to seeing the book. Now, you have something else in progress. It's Dreams from the Mountain of Concrete. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, this is a very experimental film.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to profile one former guerrilla fighter from the FARC who abandoned the armed struggle. And it's kind of connected to Shooting Cameras for Peace in the sense that when I was curating that exhibition and the students were telling me about their enthusiasm for the Pinhole project, I, you know, got back into looking at pinhole photography. So there's this whole sub world of pinhole photography. And I found a Cuban American photographer based in Boston who does some beautiful work. His name is Abelardo Morel, and I wanted to do something similar during my doctoral studies. So I did my doctoral research at Harvard and in the anthropology department, and there the institution was just adapting to the possibility of not only having a written dissertation, but also complementing the written dissertation with a piece of visual art or audiovisual photography or videography. And so I had initially thought that I would do a series of portraits with this apparatus that I kind of imagined, which was the truck camera, that we would drive a truck that we transformed into a camera obscura, kind of building on Abelardo Morel's intervention of using houses as giant camera obscuras. And I, you know, tried to be kind of a cheap imitation of Morel in a few instances, and the images didn't turn out nearly as beautiful as his. But in that process, I came to imagine a truck as a camera obscura, and what if we could take it to places of significance for people and, you know, have them pose in front of this kind of inverted background, because the visual effect of the camera obscura is that the light rays that are coming in through the hole come in diagonally. So what is up is down and what is down is up. So I started to toy around and tinker around with this truck, convincing a truck driver to allow me to open a 5-centimeter hole in one of the sides of his truck. And the first time I got into the back of the truck and we started to move, I was just really taken by the visual scene of seeing the buildings and the trees and the bicyclists and everything going by upside down. And I really was taken by the challenge of making a film within this topsy-turvy upside down world. And I had already been working with former guerrillas from the FARC on part of my doctoral program and researched it. So in that research, you see that a lot of the former rebels have these dreams that blur, you know, being in the FARC and having left. So they'll dream that they're still there, or that they've left and they're being persecuted by their former comrades, because once they leave formally within the FARC statutes, they're traitors of the movement and can be hunted down. So I thought in this kind of darkened chamber and oniric space, it might be an interesting place to evoke those dreams and those life histories for few former rebels who would be open to that experience.
And that's how you did it. I mean, you obviously clearly had to find, let's say, former rebels open to the experience. I mean, you know, to be able to share their lives. And as you say, in this period, of course, they're traitors. They're up for what the FARC would call a military tribunal, which is essentially execution for having abandoned the rank and file. I mean, how did you end up convincing someone or some people to participate?
Well, a lot of people have been open about their status already, so it's not necessarily that they were revealing a status that had been hidden. And I was quite clear from the beginning that they were guiding the interview in a sense that if there were places they didn't want to go, that we didn't by no means had to go there. We had a little bit of support from psychologists who give us a sense of how to be aware of whatever triggers there might be in the interview. And so, you know, we tried to approach it in a way that was as sensitive as possible. In the end, the project is focusing on one individual, and we're kind of building his story from joining the guerrilla to deciding to leave and trying to reintegrate into the city.
Sure, sure. Can I ask you what you know, would a psychologist make reference to as a trigger? You know, for these interviews that you had to let's say avoid.
Well, I mean, I think it's just in terms of the emotional response on the part of the people and. Then thinking about what our emotional responses would be on the other side and how to have an empathic response in case that anything would happen. Really, there was only one moment where there was a kind of welling up of emotion and sensitivity, and it really had nothing to do with the war. I think people might assume that the most sensitive pieces are pieces that have to do with the conflict. But it was a moment in when one of the former rebels was thinking about her daughters and some of the tribulations that her daughters had gone through in the city. And, you know, there we quite quickly shut down the cameras and, you know, consoled her. And, you know, in the end, in speaking to the people who participated in the project, there was this sense that it was cathartic in a way, that this project provided an opportunity to kind of get things off their chest that they had been carrying around and otherwise wanted to get off their chest.
Yeah, that was where I was leading actually, because I can see, and there have been many instances of this kind of catharsis. You know, being able to speak openly and feel it, and it's welling, you know, people may not be able to understand the emotion that comes out, but it must be cathartic. But this project is in progress, as you say, it's very experimental. But when do we expect to see this winning awards and out there in festivals and shown here in Bogota?
Well, I'm hoping for 2018 as well.
Okay,
2018 will hopefully be a very big year in terms of getting all these projects out into the open.
How do you do it all? I have to say, it's a busy, well, you're a busy guy.
I'm working with great people, working with a great team of producers in Bogota. And I've gotten a lot of help from the Shooting Cameras for Peace project from a team of interns from La Universidad de los Andes. So, you know, these projects are slow cooking projects, and to juggle them, it certainly requires help from a lot of people.
Excellent. Well, it's very good to hear that it's going on, because I'm thinking of, you know, your Shooting Cameras for Peace book, this Dreams from the Mountain of Concrete. I've seen other things. You're writing in The Atlantic. You're writing in The Huffington Post. You're an academic. You're an assistant professor. I mean, you know, I am flattered to be able to have cornered you for 40 minutes of your day. But now, tell us a little bit about this dissertation of guerrilla marketing, because I think this is fascinating. I think it's absolutely fascinating, the way of, you know, the media playing its role in Colombia's armed conflict. Now, this is something that I talk about, not from a perspective as profound as yours, but in my classes, I sit there and say, you know, you have to try and interpret the different levels and the interests behind the media, let's say, and who are the owners, what are the interests, is there self-censorship, what can be said, and you've written a dissertation around, let's say, this shifting technique of warfare. I think you could really open some of my listeners' eyes, or open our eyes to what is going on in the media, and in particular, let's say, the Colombian media.
Well, it's a big question.
It's a big question.
It's a big question. It's of critical importance, as you know, we are in a moment where the peace accord is being implemented. And one of the underlying objectives of this peace agreement is deepening democracy. And deepening democracy depends upon people feeling that they can express their ideas in a way that won't get them killed. And so the media, it's impossible to talk about democracy in the early 21st century without talking about access to the media, without talking about just how the media is structured and very much saturates everyday life. So my work focuses somewhat narrowly, as doctoral dissertations tend to do, on a particular policy, and that's the policy of individual demobilization. That is, between 2003 and the present, it will seemingly continue if the ELN remains in arms, this idea of the individual demobilization, which is a bit contradictory in the sense that the government is trying to pick people off individually out of insurgent groups, calling to them with these very highly stylized marketing campaigns, military intelligence operations, and then kind of squeezing these individuals for information that's of great value for the counterinsurgency. In any war, particularly a guerrilla war, information is absolutely crucial, and human intelligence is absolutely crucial. It enables you to corroborate technical intelligence, and a lot of the battlefield successes the Colombian military has been due in part to the information that has been gleaned from these former combatants. So essentially what I'm looking at is what I call the marketization of counterinsurgency, and how market logics and marketing become increasingly central in the counterinsurgency.
Wow. It's again, and it is a marketing. I mean, this is what I keep thinking about when you see these articles coming out and so on and so forth. But I want to, maybe you could shed some light on, I mean, you talk about the democratic access to the media and so on. You know, when we had the referendum here, which famously on October the 2nd famously was turned down, let's say, the no vote won, Santos's government had employed people from, you know, Alistair Campbell from the UK and Tony Blair and everything, all of these spin doctors, and yet he was still unable to win. There were other factors in there too, but a lot of people would speak to me and say, oh, you know, why should the FARC get you know, this many radio stations, et cetera, et cetera. And I suppose, well, you know, that's communication. That's democracy. You don't have to listen to it. I mean, you don't want to. You don't have to listen to it. What do you feel about everything that's gone on recently here in Colombia?
Well, I think in the plebiscite, the No campaign outmarketed their adversary. I mean, I think a big part of marketing is segmenting publics and dividing publics into different groups and targeting different messages to different groups. And I think the No campaign was very savvy about that, whereas the C campaign was betting at the House on this kind of universal message of peace, similar to the way Hillary Clinton was betting her House on this similar message of stronger together. And I think people have just grown weary and grown skeptical of these kind of very amorphous, positive, touchy-feely messages, I think, particularly in a context like Colombia, where the war has been raging easily since 64, if not before. This, I think people quite astutely realize that the peace accord is not synonymous with peace, which is why the intelligentsia is shifted from speaking about a post-conflict period to post-peace accord period, and a certain acknowledgement that some form of violence will persist. And so this universal message of peace, I don't think was very convincing. And I think the Santos administration was somewhat poorly advised when it came to the plebiscite. And I think the No campaign was quite savvy at looking and targeting whether it's gender-based messages or class-based messages about taxation, and using these different kind of wedge issues and different publics to drive its campaign. So, you know, the message I take out of the plebiscite is marketing is fundamental. And, you know, the plebiscite, of course, plays such an important role because it's this kind of pivot, or seemingly pivot, between these political periods. So if marketing plays such a role, such a big role in the plebiscite, it will likely continue to play a very big role in Colombian politics going forward.
Well, I think so. And as you say, the No campaign, I mean, they were so well advised. They got the algorithms for each sector of society completely right. I guess you liken it to a bit like, as you said, the late Hillary Clinton. She's still alive, but the late Hillary Clinton's campaign, let's say. How do we, you know, as we wind down, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but we wind down, how do we put the FARC into this equation and their use of the media?
Well, they've been really modulating their tone. And I think they see quite clearly that if they have any political future, it will depend upon communicating to publics that are beyond the publics that they've historically communicated to on the militant left. And I think their media integration and political integration, everybody has a vested interest in that, because, you know, as Clausewitz famously said, war is the extension of politics by other means. And so if the FARC feels that they're able to conduct politics through the media, then, you know, hopefully this cycle of political exclusion and rearmament and remobilization can be broken. So, you know, my hope is, you know, as some of the FARC leaders in Havana and elsewhere on their propaganda team, people that I've interviewed have said, you know, we're going to put down our weapons and pick up our cameras. And so that is a good trade-off as far as I can tell. And hopefully it stays that way.
Okay, well, fantastic. This has been really interesting, really, in truth, enlightening to talk about this and hear someone so informed on this, let's say, the media's role in this. I think here, when we've got this completely private and controlled media, the RCN, Caracol, it's very difficult to get anything that's even remotely objective. I studied journalism in masters in London, and I don't believe there's anything ever objective, but that's another story. Even the language we use shows a certain subjectivity, but it's really fascinating to think, and how the FARC have changed their tone. As you say, they really have changed their tone, and sometimes they come out with things and you're like, I didn't expect him to say that. You know, I didn't expect him to be so level-headed. But on that level, so what's next for Alex Fattal? What are you doing in the next coming months? I mean, you know, you've got so many things on. Give us a scoop.
No, just tying up these projects, bringing them to completion.
Okay.
Two books and a film.
Only. Merely two books and a film.
So just trying to keep the blinders on everything other than those three. Of course, I'm doing some teaching up here in Pennsylvania. I've got a few other articles in the pipeline. But it's never a dull moment.
Well, that's what I say about life here in Colombia. So listen, let me just say thank you so much for your time, Alex. It's been really interesting talking to you, and I know my listeners will have appreciated this show. Please do let us know when you're down in Bogota, and we'll take you out for a coffee, and I really want to go to the launch of this book in 2018. Thank you again. It's been really, really a fabulous interview today.
No, it's been my pleasure.
All right. Well, listen, have a good rest of the year and everything. And we look forward to your projects in the pipeline in the future. I've been Richard McCall talking to Alex Fattal there in the University of Pennsylvania up there in the United States. This has been episode 167, the last episode of the year for us. So that's a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all my listeners of Columbia Calling. Thank you for sticking with us for these 167 episodes. We keep going on to greater things. I've got more people lined up for next year, but thank you again. And that's me signing out for 2016. The next time we speak will be 2017. Bye-bye.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.